Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 13th, 2017, 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 15-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 8, Asian Funds Landscape. Chris Wells, Alex Wang, and Ethan Johnson will discuss regulations and practical insights on Asian funds in the major Asian markets. Now, on to the podcast.
I'm going to focus this on, there are lots of issues in the area, but I'm going to focus mostly on capital raise, which I think is probably of biggest concern to you. As many of you know from the seminar last year, or the discussion by Fuminaga-sensei last year, corporate and trust form funds are paragraph one securities, and those securities can only be distributed through a type one licensed institution. And so with the huge outflow of assets from Japan under the zero interest rate policy, we are seeing a number of new boutique distributors entering the market and existing managers that are active in Japan upgrading their capacity by getting additional licenses. So there's really a boom going on. In addition, the regulator is much more sensitive now to unauthorized solicitation. As I think I mentioned a couple of years ago, they don't necessarily penalize you for coming in and making solicitations that are not compliant. They go after the investor and criticize the investor for allowing you to visit them without being in a compliant form. One other major development is we're seeing the Japanese asset managers now be much more proactive about setting up privately placed domestic securities investment trusts, which then will feed into your funds. So if you're visiting Japan, be sure to visit the asset manager. There's a specific exemption that allows you to do that. If you visit the asset manager, you can ask them for a mandate, but they may in fact, in turn, invest directly in your fund. And those SIT conduit structures now are being extended. I spoke with a client this morning that will have a conduit structure in which the units and the unit trust will be publicly offered and from high net worth individuals. So it's a developing area. For paragraph two securities, I think you remember Fuminaga-sensei last year briefed you on implementation of the Article 63 amendments. Article 63 has been substantially regulated. So the ease with which you could do a self-offering of LP form funds in Japan is much more heavy. It's much more burdensome. You have to file an annual business report and you have to maintain a public disclosure document. And as a result, many of those managers that have paragraph two securities LP form funds are hiring type two managers to take them. The caution there is that even if you hire a type two manager, you may still have to file Article 63 to gain its exemptive provisions on the asset management side. If your distribution is so successful that you don't meet the de minimis test, which is that you have less than 9 Japanese investors, less than 1/3 AUM of Japanese source, and all of them have to be QII, if you violate that test, you may have to file under Article 63 in any event. One other issue that's come up in the last 3 or 4 months, there have been some large capital raises in Japan by U.S. managers, is the request, and it appears to be coming from Japan Post and the government pension fund, the Japanese Social Security system, which is now starting to allocate out of Japan, is compliance with Article 40-3 of the Financial Instruments Exchange Law, which is a fairly explicit asset segregation requirement. Asset segregation, I've made the notes here, it requires you to make sure that GP and LP have separate cash accounts maintained at a depository institution. It requires that cash equivalents, which includes virtually all securities held by the fund, be held at a regulated intermediary. And probably most important to you if you're in the process of negotiating or drafting LP agreements that are intended for Japan, you can expect to be asked to include a specific documentation requirement confirming that you are complying with Japanese rules on asset segregation. This regulation has been there for many years, but it's only recently that the focus has come back to it. Like I say, we've had to explain this provision and what it means to in connection with several capital raises recently. Documentation might be in the LPA, it might be in the subscription documents. In one case, it was in a side letter. So probably you may experience a request for restructuring parts of your arrangement to meet this requirement. Let me go on to now talk about the licensing process in Japan. The Type 1 and DIM registrations are now requiring 9 to 12 months to complete, sometimes considerably longer than that, unfortunately. The biggest single issue is finding a competent full-time compliance officer for those two licenses. They have become very expensive to find those people, but they are the key hire in the application process. We've done a number of these license applications in the last several years, and unfortunately, the Kanto Finance Bureau simply won't take your application, at least not with us, very far and without that person appearing and taking over the dialogue with a regulator. So they're expecting someone inside the company to be responsible for the license and the application. For Type 2 and investment advisory registrations, the time frame is about 7 to 9 months. It can go as long. We have one that's going into its 11th month now. Again, the biggest single concern by the regulator is ensuring that there is a sufficient compliance function. It is very hard to meet that when you're only planning to have two or three people in your office in Tokyo. And the focus is on, they'll look at the resume and they want to see knowledge and experience working in a financial instruments business operator. So even though the Japanese government has been going around internationally, at least I'm told that, saying how welcome they are for foreign asset managers, the reality is when the rubber meets the road in the licensing process, it can take time and there's a lot of detailed requests. There's also recently something, if you do have a financial instruments business operator in Japan, their FSA recently had a financial business operator principal statement. It applies across the board to all financial intermediaries for the ones that I mentioned, type 1, 2, IAA, and DIMs. You will have to issue a FBO principal statement, and it has to address these issues that I've listed here, including potential conflicts of interest, information disclosure on fees, potential for unbundling, arrangements for staff compensation that they view as overreaching. So the regulator now is very focused on making sure that there is customer-oriented or client-oriented. Most U.S. managers are pretty far along the way on this. This is Japan's sort of answer to having a fiduciary principle applicable to financial intermediaries. They don't want to have a lot of lawsuits in courts to define what that obligation means. Instead, the regulator is basically communicating greater expectations, and you can expect to see a lot of those in inspections. I have three other things that are not on the slides, which I want to tell you about, that have all happened in the last 30 days. The first one is we now have a high-frequency trading law. It's not actually, it's an amendment to the FIEA, but it will require anybody who engages in what they call high-speed trading, meaning proximity to the exchange and or low-latency trading, to register with the FSA. And that is anybody anywhere in the world that does that, okay, trading on the Tokyo Stock Exchange or other Japanese exchange. Moreover, they're going to require the PBs that handle those HFT activities to notify the FSA if they're handling it on behalf of anybody. So you really can't hide behind a Japanese licensed institution. There will be reporting, record-keeping requirements under this registration, and there will be, you know, a inspection, potential inspection and submission to jurisdiction as part of that registration. The next development is in personal information privacy. The amended PIPL just went into effect. It doesn't, you know, any database, before you had a 5,000 person database exclusion, that's gone. If you have any database that has any Japanese investor information, you have to have consent to its use, or if you don't have that, you have to comply with certain data privacy protection undertakings and requirements. Finally, there I want to mention about developments in the corporate governance area. As you're probably aware, the Abe administration is stressing that they would like to have Japanese companies have better earnings levels. And for about a year after that, the earnings popped up in Japan. but they've now declined again. So the regulator and the Abiy administration have changed the stewardship code again. They're going to require asset managers to report on how they vote at all annual shareholder meetings, which is a nice development, very big. But if you're in the shareholder engagement space, this is the golden era. I think I've never seen the Japanese government be more encouraging of both domestic and foreign managers that want to spur on Japanese performance in Japanese corporations. There was a major speech by Commissioner Mori about 2 months ago that was heavily reported, where he severely criticized the Japanese asset management industry, and part of it was in this area. And with that, I will finish and turn it over.
Thank you very much, Chris. That's very interesting. It's such one of the most mature and thorough regulatory regimes in the world. And we'll now hear from Alex and a new and budding regulatory scheme. It'll be interesting to see the comparisons.
Thank you, Ethan. And thank you, Chris, for giving us the overview of our Asian practice in the asset management industry. So as you probably know, China, not like Japan, is a relatively isolated market. So comparing to many other more developed markets, China's Asian market has much more individual investors as opposed to institutional investors. And it is a much more volatile market. And this is also reflected by the significant pricing difference, between the A-share listed in the China Stock Exchange and the H-share listed in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange for the same Chinese listed company. Despite the development over the past two decades, as we all know, China is still very far from being a free market, particularly, given its foreign exchange control regime and government interference in various investment activities. So as we all know, both capital inflow into China by foreign investors and capital outflow by Chinese investors outside of China are subject to approval by the State Administration of Foreign Exchange, the central government's gatekeeper for conversion and repatriation and remittance of foreign currency. And a lot of times, one single transaction can be subject to approval by multiple government, authorities. And also foreigners, individual or institution, are not allowed to open account to trade A-share in the China market at all. So it is against this background that China has over the years developed a number of special programs and schemes that will allow international investors to participate in the local capital markets and for Chinese investors to very limited extent invest outbound into the overseas markets. We will very briefly and quickly go through these terminologies today, but we have to be mindful that all those programs, QFII, Stock Connect, Bond Connect, QDII, all those programs are typically subject to a quota set by the SAFE, which enable the central government to control the overall volume of the cross-border investment activities. Hong Kong has always been a very important gateway for international investors and mainland China. So many Chinese companies chose to go public in Hong Kong to get access to international capital. Hong Kong is also now the biggest and the most active offshore center for offshore RMB. So the central government often leverage Hong Kong's very unique position to implement pilot programs before it can roll out new programs on a broader basis. So this Stock Connect program is the most recent one adopted by the Chinese government, allowing international investors to trade eligible Chinese stocks through Hong Kong Stock Exchange without having to remit money into mainland China or set up any local subsidiary. And the Shenzhen Hong Kong Stock Connect was officially launched in December 2016. But the Stock Connect, particularly the northbound from Hong Kong to mainland China, is still subject to a number of limitations. First, there's a daily quota currently set as RMB 13 billion for each of the Shanghai Stock Exchange and the Shenzhen Stock Exchange. And second, foreign investors can only trade designated eligible stocks in a pool. Currently, there are 572 stocks in the Shanghai Stock Exchange and 901 stocks on the Shenzhen Stock Exchange. And also because domestic and foreign invested companies are still treated very differently in China, Stock Connect does not allow a single foreign investor to hold more than 10% in one listed company, and the aggregate foreign shareholding in one listed company cannot go beyond 30%. And then Bond Connect was also recently approved by the People's Bank of China and Hong Kong Monetary Authority on May 16, 2007. But it has not been formally implemented yet. On this Bond Connect program, Hong Kong and international investors will be granted access to the China interbank bond market through the North Bond trading access. Another recent development relates to if a foreign advisor intends to raise capital and engage in investment advisory business in mainland China, it is required to set up a local entity and obtain approvals from the China Securities Regulatory Commission, CSRC. Before 2017, only Sino-foreign joint venture was allowed, and the foreign party can only be a minority shareholder holding 49% or less stake in the local joint venture. Now we have a pilot program allows foreign investment advisor to establish wholly owned subsidiary in mainland China. And then the China subsidiary can raise funds from domestic investors in China through private placement, not public offering. And then the Chinese subsidiary is allowed to invest its funds in public securities, including stocks, bonds, money market funds, asset-backed securities, futures, and other derivatives. The China subsidiary is also required to register with the Asset Management Association of China, AMAC. AMAC emerged in recent years as a very important self-disciplinary organization in China. And AMAC basically come up with a whole set of new regulations and guidelines for private fund managers in the past 1.5 years. And those regulations apply to both hedge funds, securities investment funds, and alternative investment funds. And the first wholly foreign-owned private securities investment manager was approved and registered in January 2017. QFII and RQFII. QFII basically refers to qualified foreign institutional investor. And before Stock Connect, in the past 1.5 year, QFII was basically the only channel through which international investors can access to China's capital markets. Foreign institutional investors with QFII qualification can convert foreign currency into RMB within the approved quota and then trade RMB denominated securities in mainland China's capital market. And QFII investors also legally and generally required to retain a local bank as the custodian, and then the custodian bank will basically monitor, you know, any currency conversion and the usage of the funds. RQFII is essentially the same program as QFII, except under RQFII, the foreign investors can use offshore RMB for the investment purpose without having to convert foreign currency into RMB. China, over the past 5-6 years, has becoming more and more exporting capital into the rest of the world. So many foreign investment advisors are also looking to manage Chinese capital, you know, helping Chinese sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies, you know, trust companies, securities firms to invest into the overseas capital markets. So basically, we have this QDII and QDLP and Stock Connect also as the special programs and schemes that will allow foreign managers to manage Chinese capital investing into our bond into the overseas capital markets. I guess I'm running out of time. Back to Easton.
Thank you very much, Alex. That was very interesting. And so it is interesting to see the different approaches, although some of the acronyms are shared between Japan and China. In any event, we're all available to speak about this further and by email, et cetera. So thank you very much for spending your time with us, and on to the next panel. Thank you.
To listen to other panels from the 2017 10th Anniversary Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.